Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Amy Schwartz, editor of the new book, Can Robots Be Jewish? And Other Pressing Questions of Modern Life. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Now that Hanukkah is past, Thursday night was the eighth and final night, Friday was the last day, we're approaching the end of this miserable year, 2020, and while 2020 has been something less than any of us expected, much less, to be honest, there's been some good news this year, and it came from a very unexpected area. For many years, decades, the Orthodox belief has been that the Arab world would never make peace with Israel separately from an Israeli agreement with the Palestinians that established a full Palestinian state. In fact, at the beginning of 2020, there was no reason at all to believe anything would change this year in that region. Israel has had a long, essentially peaceful and reasonably cooperative relationship with Jordan, dating back to the Oslo Process treaties in the 90s and even before that. Israel and Egypt have had a cold peace that's outlasted even the chaos of the Arab Spring of the early 2010s. But other Arab states have long refused to make any public recognition of Israel or normalize relations, even when they had secret relationships with Israel, on facing down Iran or cooperating on security in other ways. And then, suddenly this year, a dam broke. Pressured by the U.S. government under President Trump and promised a variety of U.S. arms shipments and diplomatic rewards for coming around, four Arab Sunni Muslim countries have now moved fully to normalize relationships with Israel: Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Morocco. Nobody predicted this at the start of 2020. In fact, you could have gotten longer odds from Vegas bookmakers on that bet than you would have gotten on a global pandemic shutting down the world for most of the year. And yet, it happened. Critics of U.S. President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, and there are many, may belittle these agreements and present them as tawdry end-of-season bargains with dictators. And, of course, there's the quid pro quo. Sudan was removed from the list of terror-sponsoring nations, even though they sponsor terror. And we recognize Morocco's claim to Western Sahara. Plus, there were generous American weapons sales and guarantees and grants to all the nations involved. But to be honest, it's not as if this was the only time we realized that all the Arab leaders are dictators, or notice that previous Middle East agreements were not exactly made with paragons of liberal democracy. And arms deals have been part of every peace deal in that region. The dirty details don't change the fact that something tectonic appears to be shifting in the Middle East. Now, don't believe for a second that Arab nations now recognize Israel as a good friend or a positive player in the region, or that showing love for a Jewish state is somehow beneficial to them with their populations. This is a cold calculation, as nearly all international agreements are. In this case, it's the enemy of my enemy is my friend. A nuclear Iran scares every Sunni Muslim state, which is all of them, in the region. Iran is 95% Shiite and a theocracy run by its highest religious authorities. The Arab world is predominantly Sunni and run by kings and sheikhs and presidents for life and dictators who are not Shiite. Creating alliances with the most powerful military in the region, Israel, a nation that has the technological sophistication to combat Iran's high-tech skills, and which is backed by the strongest nation in the world, the U.S., Well, that's a natural way to protect regimes that otherwise would feel very vulnerable indeed right now. With the destruction of ISIS, the danger to the conservative Arab regimes of the Middle East from radical Sunni Islam has faded. Only Syria and Iraq are still engaged in the endless civil wars against ISIS and its remnants. So now the greater threat is perceived to be from Shia Iran and its proxies, and Iran works by proxy war very effectively. So with a hard push from the outgoing United States government, the desire to counter Shia Iran's expansionism and nuclear potential, and some liberal arms shipments from America of high-tech weapons, four Arab dominoes have fallen, and Israel is the beneficiary. You know, I remember being in Morocco back in 1996 or so as part of a rabbinic mission trying to encourage the government there way back then to recognize Israel during the excitement of the Oslo peace process. Morocco held back then, waiting to see if the new Palestinian entity would become a full state. Nowadays, none of the Arab states have any great regard for Palestinian leadership, neither for Hamas, which is terror-based, radical, and incompetent, nor Fatah, which is geriatric, kleptomaniac, and hasn't held an election in decades. If you want to see this new Arab state recognition of Israel as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause, you are probably right, although it's hard to imagine things getting any better for the Palestinians anytime soon, regardless of what the Gulf states or Sudan or Morocco do diplomatically. If you prefer to see this as a major improvement for the Middle East, I'd caution you to wait and see if, say, Saudi Arabia follows suit by normalizing diplomatic relations with Israel in 2021. Hope so. But there is no doubt that Israel has won major diplomatic victories this year, in large part because of U.S. support and pressure on the Arabs. And that is definitely a positive development all around for peace. Play us in this morning. Here's the prayer Shalom Rav, the evening prayer for peace, in a setting by Cantor Meir Finkelstein, sung by Varda and Udi Spielman and Meir Finkelstein. Shalom Rav, Shalom Rav, Israel amcha tasim.
Oh, man.
That was Shalom Rav, the prayer for peace in the evening service, an appropriate sentiment and a goal for a changing Middle East. When we return in a moment here on To Jewish, Amy Schwartz, editor of the Ask a Rabbi column in Moment magazine, explains the genesis of the new book, Can Robots Be Jewish? And Other Pressing Questions of Modern Life. Find out all about them and, I guess, robots and Jews. And anyway, when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson and Catalina Foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. But in these days of coronavirus sorus, a small group joins us in person Friday night and Saturday morning by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Or come every Friday night and Saturday morning on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. with our temple musicians, and Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. The Facebook page is BEITSIMCHA Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access those by emailing me as well. Many of those classes, as well as our wonderful religious school, are available in blended formats, too, with some people live wearing masks and some on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught on Zoom and in blended format, and of course all of our services in blended format and on Facebook, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing and newest Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome our guest this morning. Amy Schwartz is the editor of a fascinating new book. I don't know how else to say it. Can Robots Be Jewish? And Other Important Modern Questions. She is the longtime Washington Post staffer who's with Moment magazine, and it's a really interesting and, well, a complicated book. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So where did the idea for Can Robots Be Jewish come from? Was it the Ask the Rabbis column in Moment? Where did you come up with the idea from?
So it's entirely drawn from the column. We have been editing. I've been editing this column for a moment for 10 years, and it's actually been running for 15 years. The Ask the Rabbis column is a very popular feature in every issue of Moment magazine, and it was dreamed up as a way to showcase and to appreciate two things. One, the sheer breadth of different Jewish opinions, the breadth and really the depth of Jewish opinions on any question you might want to ask. And secondly, really just as important, and this really emerged as I was doing the book, which is a collection of our 30 favorite questions and answers from the feature, that really showcases the fact that disagreement in Jewish thinking is not only not a problem, but really a positive good. Argument is a form of worship, kind of, in Judaism. And the fact that, so the form of the column is, we come up with a question that we think is thought-provoking, and we put it, every issue, to 10 different rabbis of 10 different denominations. We go from humanist rabbis, who make sure that you understand every time they write that they do not believe in God or any supernatural forces on the Jewish people, but they are still Jewish. These are Jewish humanists.
Yeah, I've always thought that they religiously believe that God doesn't exist. But
that's exactly right. Yes, that's very well put.
Thank you very much.
We have humanists. We have Jewish renewal rabbis, Reconstructionist, Reform, Conservative, Modern Orthodox, Regular Orthodox, Sephardi, and Chabad, and sometimes we get over farther to the right of that.
Even more Haredi than Chabad, yep.
Right, it's a little hard. Some of the people who are more Haredi than Chabad aren't super comfortable about appearing in a feature with all these different rabbis, because I guess it would in some ways tend to validate them.
Sure.
But that's their problem. I mean, I don't consider that a problem. It's just the limit on the feature. But anyway, so we ask these 10 rabbis a question, and then this is the fun part. They have to answer in 200 words. They hate that. That's not their default mode at all. But we struggle together, and we end up with these wonderful 200-word 10, an array, essentially, of 10 200-word answers, which coincidentally fits, back in the days when you weren't online, it fit beautifully in a double open page of the magazine, what we call a double truck. Anyway, so what you get when you do this is really interesting patterns of agreement and disagreement.
Often surprising ones, I find, when I've read the column.
Yes, you're a reader, absolutely. Yeah, that's always what surprises me. Sometimes, as you'd expect, the liberal rabbis disagree with the Chabad rabbis. For instance, when we asked, can Jews get tattoos? Sometimes the rabbis at the two extremes, so to speak, agree with each other but disagree with the ones in the middle. And sometimes they all agree, but they cite completely different texts and draw different lessons. So my classic example of the perfect spectrum, it would be a question like, can Jews get tattoos? Or another one we asked very early when the column first started running, we asked, should Jewish children sing Christmas carol?
Oh, yeah.
And a perennial, a good one for this season.
Yeah, ever, absolutely.
Or with any time, really. And that was a beautiful spectrum from absolutely not to sure, why not? Over a perfect range of, well, it depends. And the Reform rabbi said it depended on your child. The Conservative rabbi said it depended on what other people would think. The best one, so those are very interesting, but I find more interesting the ones where different rabbis pair up in interesting ways.
Well, let's look at some of those when we come back in a moment with Amy Schwartz. The book is called Can a Robot Be Jewish? And we'll find that out in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store or subscribing for very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about how so many American Jews say that their ancestors came from Russia or Poland. But it's really a very broad concept. I know that, for example, my grandfather came from Russia, but he came actually from Belorussia or Belarus, whatever, however you pronounce it, a little town outside of Minsk. My mom's parents came from a place called Bialystok in Poland, but of course Poland wasn't even on the map from Napoleonic times until the end of World War I. All of these places changed, And so actually, Jews in America come from, even if they come from the Pale of Settlement, as you mentioned last time, they come from a lot of different places.
Right. And of course, in this context, we're only talking about Ashkenazic Jews. And
right,
we,
of course.
We tend to erase from historical memory all the Sephardic Jews and
Oriental
the Jews from the
Jews.
Edot HaMizrach right. and the Yemenites and the Moroccans and everybody else.
Iranian Persian Jews.
Who form yep. part of the American Jewish community. So right. we have what for me is sometimes an annoyingly Ashkenazocentric view of when we say, what's Jewish foods? We don't think about burekas. We think about bagels and bialys because you just mentioned bialystok. So, Ukraine today has one of the largest Jewish populations of any country outside of Israel, depending on how you count Jews. In Kyiv alone, if you use the Nazi definition of who's a Jew, somebody with one Jewish grandparent, there's probably 600,000 Jews. Now, not all those 600,000 identify that way, but they may nonetheless be identified by their neighbors or their colleagues at work.
By the way, by comparison, that was approximately the Jewish population of the State of Israel in 1948, about 600,000. It's stunning.
Right, right. So one of the interesting things about Ukraine is that in the northwestern portion of Ukraine, a sort of regional provincial capital, is called Lviv in Ukrainian, Lvov in Russian, Lvov in Polish, but spelled completely differently, and Lemberg in German and Yiddish. So this is a very special city, which is basically the capital of the Galicianer Jews. In the same way that Vilna, which is Vilnius today, is the capital of Litvaks. Now,
Lithuanian Jews, for want of a better term.
Right. But the two major dialects of Yiddish are Galicianer and Litvak. And the differences are minor. They're just like accents and pronunciations. But in one, it's Zygazunt, and the other is Zygazint, for example. These cultures were separated by something unofficially called the Gefilte Fish Line. Because north of that line, Gefilte Fish is salty. And south of that line, it's sweet. Because there were sugar beets. And they had easy, cheap access to sweeteners. In the north, things were pickled because they had easy, cheap access to salt.
Salt, right.
So this was an important invisible frontier in Jewish history. And yet people from both Vilnius in Lithuania, the capital today, and Lviv, which for many centuries was this beautiful Austro-Hungarian city called Lemberg, all the descendants of those people would say mistakenly they're from Russia.
So interesting. And by the way, if a Litvak married a Galicianer, it was considered an intermarriage in Judaism for a long time.
Right, right.
Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Bernie is unfortunate enough to be hit by a truck. He ends up in the intensive care unit at the hospital, fighting for life. His best friend Morris comes to visit him. Bernie struggles to tell Morris, "My wife Sadie visits me 3 times a day. She's so good to me. Every day she reads to me at the bedside." "That's so nice," says Morris. "And what does she read to you?" And Bernie answers, "My life insurance policy." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. A little dark humor for this rather dark time. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Vayigash begins with the climax of the great Joseph story that fills the last sections of the book of Genesis. Joseph is now the powerful ruler of Egypt, richest country of the ancient world. His miraculous ascent from slavery and then prison to the heights of political power is the stuff that dreams are made of. He is the master of all he surveys, subservient only to a pharaoh who trusts him completely. Joseph is handsome, rich, hugely powerful, well-dressed, with a wife and two fine sons, completely assimilated into Egypt's elegant culture, and still comparatively young. The world sits at his manicured feet. But wait, there's more. For into this idyllic scene blunder Joseph's early tormentors, the very half-brothers who taunted him and beat him up. These are the conniving thugs who stripped him and tossed him into a pit in the earth and sat down to eat lunch, debating in his hearing whether to kill him or just abandon him to die of thirst and starvation, and then sold him into slavery in a foreign land instead. Now, 20 years later or so, he has the opportunity to return the favor, to exact at least a psychological vengeance on these half-brothers. After a sequence of twists and turns, Joseph manipulates these brothers into a state of confusion and terror. He unmans the arrogant, unruly rural ruffians into fearful submission. Joseph has his dish of revenge served cold, but seems to have enjoyed it. But then something changes in Joseph. Perhaps he simply tires of psychologically torturing his half-brothers. Perhaps it is that he has finally seen his full brother Benjamin again, only living reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. Perhaps it is that the fullest measure of revenge is magnanimity. Maybe it's simply that Joseph's exceptional ability to act pragmatically exerts itself. He ends the cat-and-mouse game. Or perhaps it is the stirring confessional speech his powerful half-brother Judah delivers that finally brings Joseph to a new place. Whatever the reason, now, near the beginning of Vayigash, in the dramatic high point of his story, Joseph chooses to reunite with his family. He sends his advisors, counselors, and courtiers from the room. Overcome by emotion, he cries out in a voice loud enough to be heard by all, telling the brothers, "I am Joseph." Weeping, he embraces his young brother Benjamin and asks, "Is my father still alive?" One can imagine the shock of that moment even now, 3,600 years after the events described. The brothers may have had an inkling that he was indeed Joseph. It's implied in the story, but the full revelation would have been stunning nonetheless. Their worst fears are realized. They have been and are now completely in the power of a despised half-brother they comprehensively wronged. What will happen? Joseph moves immediately to reassure them and to relieve their fears, while gently reminding them that he is the authority now. Everyone will move down to Egypt and live in land that Joseph provides for them. Even his elderly father Jacob comes down to Egypt. The family's reassembled, but in a very different configuration, for the unquestioned new patriarch is Joseph, and the great story will continue in a new land and a new direction. There's something about this story that compels us to examine our assumptions about how the world works. Unpredictable things occur. What we expect is often not what happens. Fate plays a role. The last can rise to first, and justice may ultimately be done. And in the best of circumstances, and with God's help, our own actions, like Joseph's, can begin with a base motivation and yet finally rise to a level of magnanimity and grace. So may it prove to be for us. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Amy Schwartz, explains how she gets rabbis from all across the Jewish religious spectrum to reflect on the important issues of the day, whether or not they involve robots. Find out all about it when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu, aseinu,
A court in Paris convicted one man of being accessory to murder in the 2015 jihadist terror attacks on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine and the Hyper Kasher kosher store. In addition to Ali Reza Polat, a 35-year-old French citizen of Turkish descent, three others on trial since September in Paris for the attacks were convicted of the lesser offense of being part of a terrorist enterprise. Polat was sentenced to 30 years behind bars. The four men were among 14 people on trial in connection with those terrorist assaults back in January 2015, whose actual perpetrators were killed after jointly planning the attacks. Brothers Saeed and Sharif Kouachi carried out the attack on Charlie Hebdo and were killed there after murdering 12 people. Their partner, Amadi Koulibaly, killed four people at a kosher store 2 days later before he was shot dead by police. Koulibaly also killed a police officer. Polat and the others, Nazer Pastor Al-Watik, Amar Ramdani, and Willie Prevost, who received sentences ranging from 13 years to 20 years, were prosecuted for providing the killers with the necessary weapons, equipment, or intelligence to carry out the attacks. Another six defendants were convicted of belonging to a criminal enterprise without the aggravated element of terrorism. In other news, Israel and Bhutan, a small Buddhist-majority Himalayan kingdom between India and China, have now established full diplomatic ties. Ron Malka, the Israeli ambassador to India, posted photos of the signing ceremony. Bhutan and Israel already have cordial but informal ties. Bhutan has over the last 20 years emerged from centuries of cultural and diplomatic isolation, although it has long accepted development assistance from other countries, including agricultural training from Israel since 1982. The constitutional monarchy in Bhutan is famous for a national policy that eschews materialism and instead seeks gross national happiness. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said that the announcement was the additional fruit of the peace agreements, although it's not at all clear how the ties with the remote Buddhist nation are related to the flurry of agreements Israel has signed in recent months with the Sunni Arab states, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. In Washington, D.C., the U.S. Senate passed a bill that will elevate the position of the anti-Semitism monitor to ambassador, adding punch to the envoy's mission of pressing other governments to confront anti-Jewish bigotry. Anti-Semitism continues to rise at an alarming rate across the globe, said Senator Jackie Rosen, who led sponsorship of the bipartisan bill, which passed unanimously. To equip the State Department to better address rising anti-Semitism, it's critical that we elevate the role of the special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism to ambassador at large. The U.S. House passed a similar bill last year, meaning it is almost certain to become law before the year ends and the current Congress lapses. A broad array of Jewish groups backed the measure. With the status of ambassador, the envoy will have easier access to the Secretary of State, increased funding, and the office's recommendations are likelier to be seen overseas as having the backing of the administration. The legislation provides a special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism with the tools, resources, and gravitas necessary to apply much-needed pressure on foreign governments to create more tolerant societies as part of their relationship with the United States, said Hadassah. The Orthodox Union said the Senate is providing powerful new tools, the State Department, to lead impactful international efforts to combat what has been aptly called the world's oldest form of hatred. The position of anti-Semitism monitor was created originally by Congress back in 2004. And in not such good news, the European Union's highest court upheld Belgium's ban on slaughtering animals without first stunning them, a ruling that confirms the prohibition on the production of kosher and halal meat in parts of Belgium and clears a path for additional bans across Europe. Israel rarely comments on the debate on shechita, ritual slaughter, but Israel's ambassador to Belgium, Emmanuel Nachshon, said the ruling is catastrophic and a blow to Jewish life in Europe. Two of Belgium's three states last year banned the slaughter of animals without first stunning them, a key requirement of kosher meat production. The laws were passed over the vociferous objections of Jewish and Muslim community leaders, and several groups, including one representing French-speaking Jews in Belgium, filed a petition arguing that the bans illegally limit religious freedom. Last week, the EU Court of Justice issued its decision. Bans on slaughter of animals for meat without stunning do not violate EU principles on freedom of worship. This ruling is a major defeat for efforts currently underway to challenge bans against shechita, ritual slaughter, in several EU countries, including Sweden, Finland, Estonia, and Luxembourg, where the EU court is based. It also could mean that lawmakers in additional countries impose bans without running afoul of EU rules. The ruling gives member states a free pass banning shechita in Europe, said Johan Ben Isri, president of the Belgian Jewish group that joined the petition. Europe, he said, no longer protects religious minorities. Supporters of the ban are cheering its potential to limit ritual slaughter across the continent. As Flemish people, we can be proud of this ruling, which is historic and opens the door to a ban in the whole of Europe, said Ben Waes, cabinet minister in charge of animal welfare in Belgium's Flemish region. In Judaism and Islam, of course, animals must be conscious when their necks are quickly slit for their meat to be considered kosher or for Muslims halal. This has made ritual slaughter a ripe target in Europe for both liberals who cite animal welfare and right-wing nationalists who view the custom as foreign to their country's cultures. In Belgium's Flemish region, the first to introduce a ban, the effort was led by members of the center-right New Flemish Alliance Party. In the French-speaking Walloon region, on the other hand, the ban was supported by the Socialist ruling party. Huh. The court ruled that the ban on slaughter without stunning respects the essence of the charter. It is limited to one aspect of the specific ritual act of slaughter, and that act of slaughter is not, by contrast, prohibited. Well, we will see. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Amy Schwartz, whose new book is called Can a Robot Be Jewish? And other, I think the subtitle is Other Pressing Questions of Modern Life. Some of these are pressing. Some of these are obscure. It's an incredible range. She is the editor of the Ask the Rabbi column for Moment magazine, wrote for a long time and edited for The Washington Post and other publications. Can a robot be Jewish?
That was one of our favorite questions. We asked it in the summer when you can ask sort of fun questions. And it seems like a silly question, but really it's not, for a couple of reasons. First of all, to answer a question like this, you have to think about some other questions. For instance, what makes us human? Does what makes us human also make us Jewish? If you take out the obvious markers of being Jewish, like having a Jewish mother, are there other things that control whether we're Jewish? One of the rabbis who answered this question actually took up the question of whether a robot could have a Jewish mother. And he concluded that this was something that he was not willing to accede to Bill Gates at this point in time. And since he sat on a Beit Din himself, this was the Orthodox rabbi, he really did not think a robot would make it through the Beit Din. But he was open to experience. One of the reasons you ask this question, and some of the other questions we ask, I always have in mind, could Jewish tradition possibly have anything to say about this? After all, robots were neither thought of nor dreamed of when the Talmudic rabbis were having their arguments. But, of course, as with everything, it turns out, the rabbis really have a lot to say about issues involving what makes a person Jewish and whether a machine of some kind can be Jewish. They talk a lot about the golem, the famous man of clay.
Right, of course.
Created and at crucial times to save the Jewish people. I had not known until one of the rabbis mentioned it in answering this question that the golem is thought to be one of the inspirations for Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Monster. Yes, of course. Yeah.
But it turns out there's not only is the golem a figure in Jewish folklore, but there's a lot of Talmudic discussion specifically on whether a golem should count in a minyan, which obviously bears on the question of whether the golem
is Jewish.
Is Jewish, right? And it had to do with, is the golem born of a Jewish mother? The golem is patrilineal, The golem
right.
is made by a rabbi, so it can't be
Most famously, the Maharal of Prague. But even so, it doesn't fall into the halachically Jewish category. The one thing that I missed in that discussion is nobody said only if it's circumcised.
Although I don't know if you noticed that Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, the great
yes.
modern Orthodox theorist,
yes.
had a dialogue with his rabbi in which at one point he said, can I arrange to have you circumcised?
Oh, I missed that part.
And the robot said, the robot said, no. So the rabbi moved on to things like, well, do you celebrate, do you observe Hanukkah?
Right.
What I liked most about that question was that it taught me something about rabbis also, which is that obviously a bunch of rabbis, including the most Orthodox, spent their teenage years as science fiction geeks.
Clearly.
They knew a lot about robots.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot of nerds who are robots, let's be honest. I'm sorry, nerds who are rabbis. I don't know if there's nerds who are robots. I'm not that familiar with robots.
I don't see why not. They see why.
Probably so. I think that it's obviously it's not only fun, silly questions that are asked, but questions like gene splicing and other serious science questions that come up here. What was the most surprising aspect in pulling this book together for you? You know, there's questions about organ donation. There's, you know, the things that are very relevant today.
Right. Well, I have to say the rabbis never fail to surprise me. Every question, they say something I wasn't expecting. One of the interesting questions, the organ donation question, was a great example of how halakha and the application of halakha, Jewish law, really is not, it's never a frozen thing. It's changing through time. So in organ donation, which a lot of people have a general feeling that organ donation was at one time anathema in Jewish law, that it wasn't okay, and it was, you know, didn't go with ideas of respect for the body, kavod hameit, things like that. But over time, as the science has improved, the rulings in all denominations, not only the liberal denominations, has changed. And all the rabbis address this, including the modern Orthodox rabbi, Yitz Greenberg, who gives not only a description of how things have changed generally, but how one particular decisor, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, a famous decisor of the 20th century, kept altering his views as the science came along. And that's obviously, that's not a bad thing. It's not a gotcha. It's an interesting fact about halakha that it's sensitive to science. The question about should we edit our children's genes, the CRISPR question, you might say,
right,
surprised
right.
me in another way, because I would have expected there, too, a kind of a spectrum of people finding it okay and not okay. But that was a case, often when we have questions like this, we'll reach out specifically to rabbis that we think are might have some expertise, rabbis who are doctors or rabbis who are scientists in this case.
Sure.
And turns out several of the denominations run projects specifically on this. The Reform Movement has a thing called Sinai and Synapses.
Yes, Sinai, right, right. I was
right?
part
if
of that
I got it
point.
Right?
Yep, that's correct.
Wonderful yeah. idea for a project because
it
obviously you're not neurology.
It's actually not restricted to the Reform Movement. It's trans-denominational, but that's exactly right, yeah.
This particular rabbi, I guess we just happened to use
yeah.
the Reform
sure.
rabbi, Jeff Middleman. And
I know. Yeah.
He and what I thought was interesting about this was the rabbis who weren't experts in this, who just sort of knew about it generally, talked about it in the abstract, and generally they weighed the positive and the negative, and usually they thought that, you know, there were issues. Some of them were concerned about eugenics and, you know, the Nazis and things like that. But in general, they were open to it. The people, like Rabbi Middleman and others, who actually understood the science as it exists, they said, no, 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 we are not ready. This is not happening. This was a case where if you were actually close to the details of the question, you were much more skeptical. That was what I took away from it than if you were just looking at it abstractly. So that's also a lesson of its kind.
And, you know, some of these questions are cut right to the core of issues that are all over the Jewish world now. Questions about homosexuality. It's fascinating to see something like Shmuley Boteach say, yeah, so they can't observe 613 commandments. They can observe 611 commandments, right? He's obviously Orthodox. That's not a position you see publicly stated by many Orthodox rabbis, is it?
It really isn't, although I think it may be that a lot of Orthodox rabbis are moving in that direction, but I couldn't say that for sure.
Sure.
But yes, it's funny because the question was, what would you say to your child if he or she came to you and said they were gay? And we asked this question actually 2011, so before gay marriage was legalized. As I said in the notes, I said this may be why the rabbis did not say they would immediately ask their child why they're not getting married and producing grandchildren,
right.
But generally, the rabbis seemed very open to it. And yes, it turns out that the Shmuley Boteach, that line about just focus on the other 611 commandments.
Yeah.
I have also seen it attributed to the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself, that in private, if a person came to him in anguish and said, what do I do about being gay, that's what he would tell them. He'd say, there are a lot of other ways you can be a good Jew. Let's focus on those.
Right.
But I was surprised by that, and I was also interested by, for instance, the answers to the question on abortion. We ask a question, a classic question, when does life begin?
Right.
And back in 2009, I think we asked it. It was less sort of politically fraught for the Orthodox to say, look, we don't agree with the evangelicals on this. Jewish law does not say life begins at conception. Interestingly enough, we had a rabbi from Aish answer this question. The label all we had on it was ultra-Orthodox, which we wouldn't say that now. Since then, we've come to understand that's seen as somewhat pejorative to call someone ultra-Orthodox as opposed to Haredi. But anyway, so the rabbi
kind of means the same thing, but I agree, you know.
Well, with whatever they want.
Whatever terms people prefer, sure, of course.
Yeah, but I mean the anyway. So the Aish rabbi was very straightforward. Said Jewish law: first 40 days, the fetus is considered to be like water. That is not when life begins. Life, you know, we may not like abortion for other reasons, but that's not the reason. And I remember thinking as I was editing this book, oh, they wouldn't say that today. They'd find a way to not say it. But to be fair, I was reading an op-ed by one of the spokespeople for Agudat Israel, the Haredi organization, Avi Shafran. And to give him credit, he said exactly that same thing. We agree with our evangelical friends, these are the Haredi talking, on a lot of cultural things. We don't want to be in the free love camp, but we cannot say Jewish law is different from Christian law on this. We really don't believe that life starts at conception. So that's an interestingly, I'd have to say, a sort of a liberal aspect of Jewish law that's not always appreciated. We asked a question about contraception, a much more open-ended question, and we had an interesting experience. The Chabad rabbi wouldn't answer the question. It was the only time in my experience that the rabbi came back to me and said they didn't want to answer, and his explanation was interesting. He called me and he said, I'll sometimes contact the Chabad to ask if he can find me a Chabad rabbi who wants to answer a question on a particular subject.
Sure.
Again, looking for expertise. So, and I've known this rabbi for a long time, and he called me and he said, look, a question like this, we really think only a woman should answer it. And the question was, does Jewish law offer any guidance on contraception? You know,
right.
It's open-ended. And I said, but Rabbi, this is a feature for rabbis. We're really only asking rabbis this question. That's the point of the feature. And he said, yes, but I promise you, these women I'm thinking of, they're just as good as rabbis. So I said, that's his problem, right? Not my problem. So I said, well, see what you can do. I can't use anyone who's not a rabbi. And eventually he came back to me and said, look, we'd like to skip this one if you don't mind. And I was trying to think why that was. And I presume either Chabad couldn't see being in public with a liberal position that's faithful to halakha, because the Jewish position on contraception in terms of law is also quite liberal, although culturally, obviously, there are variations. Or the opposite, or they wanted to promote astringency and they didn't want to be in public, you know, as with the homosexuality question, they didn't want to be the ones who came out saying no when everyone else was saying yes. So I don't know what exactly was going on with that, but I thought it was an interesting reflection of where although there's a spectrum, it's more a spectrum of, and this is true of a bunch of the questions. It's one of the things I like about one of the things I learned from this, even where the vocabularies are different and so you appear to have disagreement, there's often a surprising amount of underlying agreement. So you'll have
quite a bit. And, you know, it's fascinating, even on questions like transgender, which has been such a hot button issue in recent years, pretty much all of the rabbis across the spectrum come up with a pretty accepting view. It's quite fascinating to see.
Isn't it remarkable that the Talmud recognizes five genders going all the way back? There's this discussion of, I mean, you would think, the question was sort of, does the tradition have anything to say about anything to offer people who are transgender. I think that was the wording. And the answer is, sure enough, they have a ton. They talk about it all the time. And
all the time.
Once I thought about it, I realized, in general, the Talmud talks about sex a lot more than you'd think.
Oh, yeah.
But, which is another one of the takeaways of this book. There's a whole chapter on just on sex, with questions and answers about sex. But the trans thing, it made me think about it and say, well, you know, the ancient world had things like eunuchs, which we don't see a lot of. And so it's naive of us to think that these problems are aspects of modernity. They're just aspects of human nature, as far as we can tell. That's also true of contraception, was another interesting thing. I mean, this isn't a problem that people just started trying to solve yesterday.
Not at all. I want to thank Amy Schwartz for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Can Robots Be Jewish? And it's a great read. It's worth picking up for 5 minutes. You'll learn something interesting about rabbinic and Jewish positions and read the whole thing straight through. It's great as well. The only problem I have is you've never asked me to write one of these columns, Amy. I'm so disappointed. So I just...
Oh, Rabbi. I thought you'd never ask.
Amy, thank you. Where can people go to find out more about you, find out more about the book?
So there's the book is available at momentmag.com. It's supposed to be available at Amazon, but the delivery date got screwed up. So if you want it sooner, you should come directly to our website, momentmag.com.
Great.
Yeah, and there's some information about me in there, too, in the staff section. I'm supposed to be getting a personal website, but since this is my first book, I haven't quite put
well,
it together
about
yet,
time. Get, you know, it's
my work, if you look at them, if you Google me, I'm all over the internet.
Your work is far from done.
Written a lot.
Yeah, you certainly have.
Amy, thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our play out this morning, well, it's a prayer for healing, sung by Baruch Levine for all who are suffering now, including from the COVID-19 pandemic. May they all achieve healing speedily and soon. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Professor Mark Kligman, discussing the new Lowell Milken Center for Music of the American Jewish Experience, just founded at UCLA. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and, God willing, of peace.
Avinu, Avinu, Malkeinu, Shlach Refuah Shleima, Refuah Sanefesh, Refuah Saguf, L'choylei, L'choylei Yamecha. Avinu Malkeinu Shlach Refuah Shleima Refuah HaNefesh Refuah HaGuf L'choylei L'choylei Amecho
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.